stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion for this Wednesday afternoon. We are live and we are delighted that you are with us. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, please feel free to contact us in any way that you can to get those questions answered, because we know that a lot of non-Catholics listen to this show to get those answers. That is why we are here. We're continuing our little issue here with the phone system. Well, hopefully we'll have that remedied in the next day or two, and we're certainly working hard on that. Meanwhile, you can contact the show several different ways. You can shoot us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. You can text the letters EWTN to 58177, wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, because we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. Social media guru Ace McKay handling all that. He'll get those questions to us here in the studio. Our producer today, Pedro Quiles. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, sir?
Oh, doing decent. Thank you.
The weather has broken just a little bitty bit.
Yeah.
And we're really happy about that.
Very happy.
So we're going to begin here with a couple of questions from Doug in Oregon, who wrote to us. He says, Dr. Anders, I have two questions for you. Number one, how did the Shroud of Turin end up in the custody of the Pope? And number two, is the Shroud of Turin the actual burial cloth of Jesus? Thanks. Blessings to you and the team. Doug in Oregon.
Yeah, thanks, Doug. So I have not personally made study of the Shroud of Turin and its history a major part of my apologetical repertoire, so to speak. So I have read and heard the history of its transmission before. I can't repeat it for you. I don't remember how it got where it landed right now. Honestly, I just don't know. I have forgotten that. Do I personally believe the Shroud of Turin was the actual burial cloth of Jesus? I have absolutely no idea, and I have no dog in the fight. Right? For myself, my faith in Jesus is not based on the authenticity, alleged or otherwise, of the Shroud of Turin. If somebody came out with a smoking gun proof that it was not authentic, it would have no effect on my practice of the Catholic faith. I personally, as of yet, have not encountered the smoking gun absolute proof of its authenticity either. I have read arguments for its authenticity, none of which I am professionally qualified to evaluate, because they involve highly technical scientific arguments and the use of machinery that I don't understand. So I will listen to someone who makes an argument based on some sort of, electrochemical analysis.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm putty in their hands. So somebody starts talking at that level of science that I know. I mean, I had high school chemistry 37 years ago, And they say, well, that's what chemistry shows. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And I know enough about rhetoric and confirmation bias that I have a great respect for expert opinion, right? But I also know, as a doctoral student myself, as a PhD myself, I know how to marshal learning to advance an agenda and to wrap somebody else around my intellectual axle. I know how to use data to manipulate. And that kind of evidence for me can never be determinative, because I'm sort of beholden to the last most persuasive expert that I've heard.
Sure.
I find it interesting. It's fascinating and all that sort of thing. But my faith just doesn't hang on the authenticity or otherwise of the Shroud of Turin.
Doug in Oregon, thanks so much for contacting us here at EWTN's Call to Communion. Here's a question now from Joyce in Nebraska. When Moses led the people out of Egypt, didn't they take their herds with them? And if so, why did they later need quail for meat? Thanks from Nebraska. And again, that's from Joyce.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't think the text tells us. I also think that the narratives of the Old Testament contain a number of inconsistencies, and this is one that you have pointed out.
Uh-huh.
There are others that that sort of baffle historical imagination. I'll give you a classic example. When Elijah flees to Mount Horeb, okay, he leaves Judea and he runs to, well, I guess, was he in Judea? Well, anyway, he leaves wherever Ahab was.
Yeah.
And he runs to Mount Horeb. And the text tells us that he runs for 40 days and 40 nights. Shows up at Mount Horeb. Well, do the math. You go get out your Google Maps and you figure out how long would it take you to walk, you know, from Jerusalem or its environs or Samaria to Mount Horeb. And, you know, Google will tell you, if you walk it, that's how many hours it takes you. You can get it done in a lot less time than 40 days and 40 nights going nonstop,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So but the astute reader will know, where have I heard this 40 days and 40 nights language before? Right, you know. And it is it's obviously evocative of something. This is a symbol that, okay, Elijah is stepping, as it were, into mythic time here, right? And it's evoking, okay, this is, I'm supposed to find some transcendent meaning here that is above and beyond the historical narrative. And in fact, that's the way the church fathers read the narratives of the Old Testament. When they encountered difficulties like this, their response was to say, okay, on the surface, this appears to be an error or a contradiction. The point of that is to wake me up and tell me not to read this text at the literal level, but to look for the allegorical or the spiritual significance. And then they would begin to spin out their allegorical and spiritual interpretations. So I think that's the way I handle the text of the Old Testament. I'm not so concerned about trying to lay out a chronological timeline and make all the pieces fit together, because I don't think that's the point of the story.
All right. And Joyce in Nebraska, we thank you so much for your email. Again, if you would like to send us an email for a future show, we would love to receive it and hopefully get it on the air for you. That address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. The way we are blasting through emails these days, we need a fresh supply from you. ctc@ewtn.com. Or if you'd like to shoot us a text, you can do that right now. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Excuse me. You can also send us a question via YouTube or Facebook. We're streaming on both those platforms right now. In a moment, a fascinating question from Ramon that many people have asked over the years. We'll get to that. We'll also get to one from Gloria. And a few more on today's Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Not taking your phone calls today, but you can certainly contact us by shooting us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. We're going to get to a great question from Ramon in just a moment here. First of all, let me tell you about something special we have for you on Friday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern. It is a special called Becoming Francis, The Making of a Pope. EWTN foreign correspondent Colm Flynn visits and interviews the places and people that would shape the young Jorge Mario Bergoglio in his life as a priest and as Archbishop of Buenos Aires before his election to the papacy back in 2013. You'll learn about his conflicts with the government and the roots of his devotion to and focus on the poor through reflections from local companions, from his confessor, to the man who worked as his media secretary and spokesman for over a decade. It's a special on Friday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television and EWTN Radio, Becoming Francis, The Making of a Pope. I think you'll find that quite interesting. All right, here's that email now from Ramon, who says, how do you interpret, Dr. Anders, the extremely long lifespans recorded in the book of Genesis?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. You'll note that in the story of the flood, one of the curses that God pronounces on the human race is that he will limit the lifespans and that nobody is going to live beyond 120 years after that point. And then the first biblical character who is, we are told, dies at age 120 explicitly, is Moses. And in the Old Testament, Moses stands as something like the archetypical human person. He's sort of an antitype to, he's sort of a typology for Christ. And the New Testament makes that identification very clear. One of the metaphors that it seems to evoke in depicting Jesus is the new Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way that Christ is the second Adam and sort of the archetype of the recreated human race, Moses is the archetype of, so the Old Testament ideal of the human person who fulfills within himself, you know, the fullness of the years allotted to the lot of men, so to speak, 120 years. But this is a function of the covenantal order that God establishes after the flood. And I mean, there's a fundamental break in the Genesis narrative between the first 11 chapters and then the call of Abraham. And this first 11 chapters are, I don't take them literally, right? Take them literally at all. So I don't think that there were historical humans that were living for 1,000 years. But I think that evokes something about the way the sacred writer wants to tell the story of humanity and its relationship to the deity and its sort of discovery of moral responsibility and the imposition of the law and so forth.
I'm glad you brought that up on this day, which is the day that the church observes the Feast of the Transfiguration, where Jesus is speaking with Moses and Elijah.
There you go.
That's fascinating. All right. Thanks so much, Ramon, for your email. Here's one now from Glory, who says, Dr. Anders, I remember on a previous show, you mentioned going to confession and struggling with confessing the sin over and over. I find myself in that exact place. I've gone to confession, but I keep feeling so guilty for this sin. It keeps weighing on me, and I just can't let it go. My sister told me that thinking this way dishonors God's glory, as if I'm doubting His mercy. Well, I know she's right, but my heart still aches, and the guilt robs me of peace. Do you have any advice or maybe a word of comfort for someone with a sorrowful heart like mine? Thank you, Glory.
Yeah, I do. Thank you very much. Appreciate the question. So your sister's criticism, if I understand it correctly, is that by being hard on yourself regarding your sins, that you are somehow diminishing God's glory and diminishing the extent of His mercy. So in response to your guilt feelings, your sister has added yet another guilt feeling.
Thanks, sis.
All right. That is not the pastoral advice I would give you personally.
Okay. All right.
So the first thing I would want to know, and we're not doing spiritual direction via email through the radio here, but is it really a sin? That's the first thing I want to ask, because a weakness isn't the same thing as a sin.
Mm.
Sometimes people get real bent out of shape and hard on themselves because of a weakness in their character that doesn't really constitute a sin, because it's not something that one willfully does with impunity, knowing it to be wrong, right? And maybe there's a touch of scrupulosity going on, and that's something to investigate with a spiritual director, okay? The other question is, well, how does one actually get over habitual sins? And this is, take it from somebody who has failed to get over habitual sins, so like that's my authority on this, but I've studied the issue and I know what needs to be done, even if I sometimes fail to do it myself. And that is both theology and psychology confirm the central truth that moral change doesn't typically happen through the mere exertion of willpower, because willpower is a fading resource. You burn it up and then it lasts for a while. You know, you look at the pecan pie that sits on the counter and you'd like to eat it and you go, No, I'm not going to eat it. Well, I'll just take one bite. And the next thing you know, you've eaten half the pie, right? And you hold off for a while, but it always kind of fades, and you give in at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way to do it, all right? The way to beat temptation, and habitual sin in particular, is you have to come up with a system. You have to change the organization of your life such that the temptation doesn't occur. And so, you know, in the case of the pecan pie, for example, well, you have a system. The system is, I'm not going to have pecan pie sitting on the center island of my kitchen to tempt me. I'm going to have a ban on the importation of pecans into the house. you know,
wow.
like you know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm being facetious, I'm being comical, but I mean, this is, the addicts have known this for a long time. You know, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, they'll tell you to stay away from the people, the places, and the things that trigger the habit to drink.
Right.
Because they know that once the thing is triggered, you're hopeless. Like you get into you're locked into a pattern of behavior that you can't extricate yourself from, and you're just toast, right? So the trick is to not put yourself in those situations where the temptation is going to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may have to reorganize your life a bit to avoid those occasions of sin. And that does not simply require willpower. It does require planning and intentionality, but not that kind of gritting your teeth and mm-hmm. bearing it kind of willpower.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's speaking literally at all. I mean, I think this is kind of what Jesus is talking about when he says, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. Well, I mean, please don't gouge out your eye, and please don't cut off your hand. But the idea is you take away the things that are the occasions of sin so that the temptation won't occur. And that is the way you do it. And you do it in community, you do it with support, you do it with a confessor, you do it with Catholic friends that can rally around you and help you. You find something to replace the bad habit. There are a lot of good scientific works and sort of pop psychology works on habits and habit formation and what the neurologists have learned about habits. Mm. And what they basically all say is that once you've laid down a bad habit pattern, you don't ever really unlearn it, which is why, you know, the addict that hasn't used in 30 years uses again and goes straight back, not to the beginning of his addiction, but to the point he was at the end of his addiction, right? Those neural pathways are laid down. They don't ever go away, right?
Yeah.
And what you have to do is you have to lay down new neural pathways. And so usually in most habitual behavior, there's the trigger, there's the behavior, there's a reward. And so what you have to do is you have to intentionally insert another behavior in response to the trigger. So, you know, if the trigger is, I feel sad, I pour a drink, the reward is I temporarily feel better, right? You have to consciously set out to say, okay, I feel bad, I do 10 push-ups, I feel better, or whatever it is. But you make a decision, whenever these triggers occur, I'm going to insert mm-hmm. You develop a new habit pattern.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
These are the kind of things you have to do. So just simply, I did this thing again, I feel bad, I'll go to confession, I'll do penance, I'll beat myself up, and it'll last until the next time I do the thing again, and then I go to confession. And people can do that pattern for the rest of their lives,
yeah.
right? You've got to step in and make some kind of extraordinary intervention into the structure of your life. I mean, this is what the whole business of monastic life was supposed to be about. Construct a life, construct a community
uh-huh.
that facilitates the practice of virtue. We don't really do this anymore in Catholic life. It's the concept of a rule of life.
Yeah.
And spiritual directors will tell you, you know, if you want to make progress, it's not enough just to mechanically go through the practice of the Catholic faith and the sacraments. One of the things you need to construct a rule of life that will facilitate the practice of virtue in your case. You do it in accord with what your particular vocation is, your state of life, your particular strengths and weaknesses, but work with somebody that can help you come up with a rule of life that will help prevent these lapses in the future.
Glory, thanks so much for your email. We would love to hear from you today on EWTN's Call to Communion. Our email address, ctc@ewtn.com, or text the letters EWTN to 58177, or contact us via YouTube or Facebook. We're streaming on both those platforms. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. Fascinating question here from Andrew. Dr. Anders, I'm currently taking a theology course on Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma by Dr. Ludwig Ott as the main textbook, supplanted by selections of other texts. While on the Sacrifice of the Mass section, I read something that was contrary to my catechesis on the Mass. It was my previous understanding that Mass is basically like a time machine, where, at the consecration, that around the altar, Calvary is mystically present, like we went back in time. Dr. Ott seems to think this view is not tenable, per Pope Pius XII, Mediator Dei. He'll also speak of a mystical immolation at the consecration. Please explain these two concepts. Thanks, Andrew.
I love the fact that you asked this question.
This is red meat for you.
Oh, yeah. I love that you asked this question. And I love that it was Ludwig Ott that raised the problem in your mind, right?
Yeah.
Because I have read Ott personally on the sacrifice of the Mass. I've read the discussion you're talking about. I've read his references to Mediator Dei. I have read his analysis of where the, as he calls it, the mystical view of the sacrifice comes from, its relationship to the liturgical movement of the 19th century, to the influence of those particular thinkers. I know this argument, I know this debate, and I think Ott is entirely right, and I think the time travel people are absolutely dead wrong. Now, you're correct. The time travel view is amazingly well distributed across the modern catechetical world, and you find it a lot of places. And I mean, please don't do this, but if you Google search sacrifice, mass, time travel, which I have done, I mean, you will find people who make the explicit argument. I mean, without qualification, mass is a form of time travel. It is not. It is emphatically not a form of time travel, and that contradicts Catholic dogma, even though many, many, many modern Catholic catechists make that mistake. So what are the ultimate origins of this thing? So in Calvinism, the Protestant tradition called Calvinism, John Calvin tried to split the difference between Lutheranism and Zwinglianism on the nature of the real presence. See, Luther thought that Christ was truly present in the Eucharist. Zwingli thought that he was only symbolically present. And that was splitting Protestantism down the middle. So Calvin tried to split the difference, and he argued, well, Christ is really present, but not locally. He's not just a symbol, but it's not sort of, it's not, you know, a kind of presence you can hold in your hand. And Calvin's view was on the occasion of taking communion that God mystically conjoins two things that are separated in space, namely the body of Christ and your body, through the agency of the Holy Spirit in a way known only to God. So he affirmed a kind of real presence, a real partaking of Christ's flesh and blood, but through this sort of mystical medium, not one that is, that you can hold in your hand. And in my view, what has happened in Catholic catechesis regarding not the doctrine of the presence, but of the doctrine of the sacrifice, is that they've imported something kind of analogous to the Calvinist doctrine of the real presence, namely, oh, there's a real sacrifice, but it's not one that you can hold in your hand, so to speak. There's not a sacrifice on the altar. No, 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 says the modern catechist. It's a mystical conjoining with the once-for-all sacrifice that took place on Calvary. So this kind of a sort of an analogy to what Calvin was doing. That's dead wrong. That is absolutely not what the Church teaches. The Council of Trent teaches dogmatically. This is a dogma that every Catholic must believe. It does not teach that the Mass simply evokes or memorializes or somehow mystically renders present what took place on Calvary. It teaches that the Mass is itself, by itself, independently, a true and proper sacrifice. That when you go to Mass, that the sacrifice that the priest makes on that altar is itself a real sacrifice that has propitiatory value, that is distinct from the sacrifice that he'll make tomorrow and distinct from the sacrifice that he makes yesterday. And so to say, well, the priest isn't really sacrificing, all he's really doing is opening a time machine to Calvary, is to deny the dogma of Trent, which says the Mass is a true and proper sacrifice. Furthermore, in terms of the real presence, the Church does not teach that the real presence of Christ is reaching back in time to pull the dead Christ off the cross and make him present on the altar. It does not teach that. It tells us that the real presence of Christ, the body and blood of Christ that are present on the altar, are Christ as he is in his proper person right now. So Christ in heaven, today, not 2,000 years ago Jesus, but today Jesus, comes down from heaven, is made present on the altar. So the body and blood that you're receiving is the glorified risen Christ, not the bleeding, dying Christ of Calvary 2,000 years ago. And again, this time travel business not only makes mincemeat of what Trent says about the nature of the Mass as a sacrifice, but it also deforms the nature of Christ's presence as such. It messes with the doctrine of transubstantiation. So I think it's just, and it doesn't have any precedent in antiquity, in the Fathers, in the Scholastics, in the Doctors of the Church. Where did it come from? I think it's a misguided ecumenical effort to dismiss the Protestant charge that the Mass is a true sacrifice. So it concedes the Protestant criticism in a way and then tries to give us a quasi-Calvinistic solution to the problem.
Andrew, we hope that's helpful for you. Thank you so much for your email. Lots more straight ahead on this edition of Call to Communion. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Glad that you're with us. You can shoot us an email. Still some phone issues, but we're going to blow past all that. We'll be glad to get your questions via email, ctc@ewtn.com, or send us something on YouTube or Facebook. Just put your question in the comments box. Here's a little bit longer email that we received from Emika. Actually, this is from Collins. Collins says, was God the one who opened the ground in Numbers 16, verses 28 through 35, blinded those who came to attack Elisha in 2 Kings 6:18, destroyed the Jerusalem temple and those who killed Christ, as Luke 20, verse 16 says, destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, all these things? If the answer is yes, was God the one? How do I reconcile this with the truth that God is love? I had a discussion with a fellow Catholic. He seems to be saying God merely permitted it, and that's why it says God did it. Well, I'm familiar with the principle of God permitting, and I use it in passages like God hardening Pharaoh's heart, God causing David to take a census, but I can't seem to apply that same principle in the above passages that I listed without violating my conscience. Am I right, Dr. Anders, in saying God directly inflicted those punishments?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the problem is more acute than you suggest.
Okay.
It's more acute than you suggest. The prophets go so far as to ascribe to divine agency such atrocities as the ripping open of pregnant women and the bashing of infant heads against rocks.
Wow.
Right? I mean, they are ascribed to divine agency. He will do this to us. He will do this to you, they threaten. Okay. And if you have read the book of Lamentations, Prophet Jeremiah talks about the horrific suffering of Jerusalem under the exile and the Babylonian invasion. And he says, God did this to us because of our sins. And the Deuteronomist clearly teaches this theology that human suffering and misery is the direct result of disobeying the divine law, and this is the punishment that God metes out on sinners. So there it is. It's in there. Okay. Then you read the book of Job. And Job goes out of its way to tell us that the character Job had done nothing wrong, that he was righteous in all his generations, he was a perfect, upright individual, had done nothing wrong. And God inflicts all of this horrific stuff on Job for the most trivial of reasons, to win a bet. To win a bet. And Job's friends come around side, and they're all Deuteronomists. They all are familiar with this narrative theology that says if bad things happen to you, it's because you've sinned and you deserve it. So they urge Job to repent. And God says, Job says, I'm not going to repent. I hadn't done anything wrong. And I call God to account because he's responsible and I don't deserve this. And then in a very bizarre turn of events, God shows up at the end of the book and he says to Job, essentially, number one, how dare you question me? I'm God. I can do what I like. Then he turns around and says to Job's companions, I'm really upset at you guys. And if you want me to listen to your prayers, what you had better do is go out and get sacrificial offerings, give them to Job. Job will offer sacrifice on your behalf, and I will listen to him, but not you.
Wow.
And then he turns around and rewards Job. So we have this bizarre situation where Job questions God's justice, is rebuked by God for doing so, and then rewarded by God in the same breath. Then you have the doctrine of Ecclesiastes, Qohelet's doctrine, which is that in the face of all this injustice, maybe the right thing to conclude is there's no God at all. And that gets put in the canon. Then you have the psalmist, who has an analogous position. It's not exactly the same as Ecclesiastes. Uh-huh. And he says, all this bad stuff has happened to me. It seems to me there's no God, which is not the same thing as there's no God, right? It says it feels like God is absent here.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get Daniel's doctrine, which is altogether different. And in Daniel, you begin to find the first hints of the genre of literature that would come to be called apocalyptic. And apocalyptic as a genre of literature emerges out of the following realization. Israel as a whole was more like Job than otherwise. And stuff happened to Israel in the exile that seems to defy moral imagination, that does not seem to be a proportionate response to the sins of the people. And unwilling to draw the conclusion of Ecclesiastes that there's no God, and finding, you know, Job's response inadequate from the point of view of theodicy, which is, say, to justify the ways of God, apocalyptic introduces another element, which is, well, maybe there is an intervening force. It's not God acting directly. Maybe there are malevolent forces in the cosmos that act against the people of God. And they're the ultimate source of human misery and suffering. And they will ultimately be defeated by God. And so you begin to get the development of a more elaborate angelology and demonology and so forth, which gets imported into the New Testament. So we have all these multiple threads. There's different responses to the problem of evil and injustice in the Old Testament and the New Testament scriptures. And what does Jesus say? Well, when Jesus observes and comments on tragedy that occurs in people's lives, sometimes he says, you can't conclude from this that this person has sinned. Right? When the Tower of Siloam falls, don't say, did it fall on people because they were worse sinners than the rest? He says, no, they weren't worse sinners than the rest, but hey, you guys over here, you better watch it or something worse is going to happen to you. So he kind of talks out of both sides of his mouth. On the one hand, these people didn't suffer because of their grave sins,
mm-hmm.
but you fellows over here are sinning gravely, and therefore you might suffer. But what's going on here? And then he says about the blind man in John chapter 9, the disciples come and say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents was responsible for his sin, for his blindness. This happened that the work of God might be completed in him, might be shown in him. So it's not a response to their moral deficits,
uh-huh.
but there is some intelligible purpose within God's providential order. So you have this wide range of views that you find in the Old and New Testament about our relationship to evil, whether we deserve it or not, whether God is the agent that's directly responsible for it. And all these texts give different perspectives, right? The fathers of the church looked at all of this stuff, and their initial response was very much in line with your intuition, that there are some things in the Old Testament narratives that cannot be taken at face value without impugning the justice and the character of God. And so when they encountered those, they read them according to their spiritual or allegorical sense. Great example of this would be Gregory of Nyssa's book, The Life of Moses. When he goes through elements in the life of Moses, and sometimes he encounters stories from the Exodus when God behaves in ways that seem irreconcilable with any intuition we have about justice or equity. And Gregory says, well, we shouldn't take those at face value. Those are obviously not to be taken literally, those are to be taken allegorically. We read them in a way that is more in accord with divine justice and divine mercy. And then all of this, I won't say it gets reconciled rationally, but I think it gets reconciled existentially in the soul, as it were, in the person of Christ.
Hmm.
Because this is the one perspective that I haven't mentioned yet, in the prophets, you begin to get the sense that, all right, there is some of this suffering that I can't find the intelligibility. Mm-hmm. I can't assign a reason to it. I can't rationally justify it. But through this experience of suffering, the servant of God somehow or another brings life to the people of God. You find this in the servant songs of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
And though Isaiah seems to be speaking about the collective, all of that gets sort of focused down into a singular representative individual in the New Testament in the person of Jesus. And the New Testament writers say what the Old Testament prophets said about the servant of God, that is preeminently true of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that through his entering into the experience of suffering and death and resurrection, he reconciles humanity to God without ever really dissolving the mystery of evil. So he doesn't give us a rational explanation of the problem of evil. He gives us an existential pastoral response to evil. And then Catholic mysticism picks up the story from there. And it says, you know what? God is beyond understanding. God is a mystery that I can't fathom. The rationally the best thing I can say about God is what he's not. So-called apophatic tradition in theology, the negative theology. God's not this, God's not that, right? I can't state what he is. It's too high and mighty and beyond me, right? But when I enter into this experience of horrific suffering that defies imagination and seems to defy justice, if I align myself with the personality of Jesus, what I find is that the experience can become transformative for me. It's nothing anyone would ever choose, but it begins to work on my character and my disposition so that I begin to see the world another way. And as long as I don't dissolve into bitterness or into immoral fantasy as a way of coping, I find that I become more loving, I become more patient, I become more humble, I become more like Christ. This is the dark night of the soul that the mystics like John of the Cross talk about. And they are able to incorporate all those sentiments of atheism that you find in the Old Testament, that railing against God and wondering if he even exists. And they begin to tell us, yes, if you really want to grow close to God, you must die to your false notions about God. And Meister Eckhart, speaking very evocatively and not to be taken literally, says, if you want to know God, you have to give up everything, including God. Not God, but like your false notions of God.
Yes.
You have to die to those,
yes.
Right? And enter into the mystery of his being, where the only participation, where the only knowledge of God you have isn't by rational analysis, but by participation, where your character has been transformed. You begin to see the world through the eyes of Christ, right? And so all of that diversity, all of incompatibility, all that incoherence in the Old Testament view of suffering becomes reconciled in the heart and the experience of the Catholic mystic who's ultimately transformed through all of it into charity.
Collins, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your very high-level question there. Appreciate that. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We want to give a little shout-out now to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating 10 years with us, KYEJ 90.1 FM, serving Fairmont, Minnesota. Congratulations to Steve Landsteiner and everybody there at Fairmont Area Catholic Radio from your friends here at EWTN. We have a text that just came in. This is from Joe. Dr. Anders, what does it mean to be poor in spirit?
Thanks. So, the majority position in Catholic interpretation is something essential to equivalent to humility, right? You know, not thinking too highly of yourself, not aspiring after the wrong sorts of things.
Okay. Very good. Here's a question now from Chris. Excuse me. Chris says, I had previously asked but didn't get to listen to the show when these questions were answered. So could you please re-answer my questions here? And there are two of them. Number one, love to hear Dr. Anders' view on all dogs going to heaven. I see it more as God gives us animals to lead us to heaven, and we are to take care of our world, and cruelty to animals will be included in our own judgment. Second question, what happens to a soul that dies with wealth? Alternatively, what happens to a soul that dies without wealth and or a lot of debt? Sincerely, Chris. Do you remember both those questions?
Yeah.
Okay,
so all dogs go to heaven. There's nothing in the Catholic faith or philosophy to suggest that animals have immortal souls, right? And the condition of eternal life, seems to be having an immortal soul. And certainly of moral responsibility and of justice and merit and reward. I mean, these things require that one be a moral agent, and animals aren't moral agents as such, right? Nevertheless, Scripture tells us that all of creation will be renewed at the coming of Christ. Now, the whole going to heaven when you die thing is a little bit of a distortion of Christian eschatology, because ultimately the Christian faith does not view eternity as a disembodied existence in a celestial heaven, but of a resurrected body on a renovated earth, right? In which case, the question of the immortal soul or otherwise may be less significant, and the question, will there be animal life in the eschaton? I find that easier to answer in the affirmative. Like, do I think my particular dog, Harry, much as I love him, do I think he has an immortal soul such that when he dies, you're going to have one of those Looney Tunes little Harry doppelgangers that floats up and sits on the power line with a harp and watches, you know, the cats run below him? No, I don't think he has that kind of existence. It's going to, you know, but will something that will meet the emotional need of Harry in my life exist in a glorified way in the eschaton? I find it probable. Why have a material creation populated only by one species? I mean, okay. God didn't see this world in that light. I mean, he didn't just, you know, make us all in a white rubber room and a bunch of humans. He made all a tremendous diversity of biological life, right? I don't see any reason to deny that he would continue to do that in the renewed heaven and the earth in the eschaton. Whether that'll contain my particular dog or not, you know, I find that less persuasive.
Okay.
What happens to a soul that dies with wealth? What happens to a soul that dies with debt? It really depends on what one does with one's wealth when one is alive. I mean, there are people who make of their wealth a tremendous opportunity to do good to others. Mm-hmm. There are also, you know, there's also Ebenezer Scrooge. There's also those who make of their wealth an idol that that isolates them from the love of God and neighbor, and that would be devastating. What happens to a soul that dies with debt? Well, they don't pay their debts, you know.
I mean, that's about it,
right? I mean, it's not necessarily a sin to die with debt. I mean, it could be a sin if you are the sort of person who, I mean, I've known people who do this who they say, oh, you know, I got terminal cancer. I'm gonna be out of here in 6 months. I think I'll run up to credit cards. Well, I mean, that's not a good attitude, you know. I mean,
no.
So I mean, you're not going to pay back the debts, obviously, but I mean, that's a decision to take advantage of other human beings, and that's not kind either.
Chris, thanks again for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We got this one from Hannah. Dear Dr. Andrews, do Catholics believe that ancient pagans worshipped actual demons, or that every pagan god corresponded with an individual demon? It seems to me that the gods themselves, small g, were just human invention or myth, and that it's unhelpful to think that the whole society engaged in demon worship. I like reading ancient mythology, but thinking of them as demons is a real buzzkill. Thanks, Hannah.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So there certainly were church fathers that took the pagan gods are all demons angle. I mean, that you find that in Christian antiquity.
Okay.
But I agree with you. I don't find that doctrine entirely helpful or persuasive. And, I mean, clearly there are occasions in ancient mythology where the gods evoke deeply human and immoral passions, right? You know, when you have a god, I mean, like, I don't see how Bacchus can be anything other than, you know, a bad image for humans to imitate, right? You know, I mean, nobody needs to go out and imitate Bacchus, you know. But the philosophers began to move away from that kind of anthropomorphic depiction of the deities. And, you know, Plato in particular thought that if myth was useful at all, it would be in moving us towards the good. And so you begin to have these allegorical interpretation of the myths and so forth. And which really do anticipate some moves in the New Testament. I mean, this is kind of what the New Testament does with the Old. And the allegorical interpretation is borrowed by the New Testament writers from pagan antiquity as a way of mitigating a bit some of the earthiness of pagan mythology. And you know, now, I mean, since Carl Jung, the tendency is to try to read pagan myth, you know, not as literal narrative, but as a, you know, archetypal of elements of human personality. And you see that a lot in popular figures like Jordan Peterson. They like to read the stuff that way. And I mean, I find some of that can be useful. C.S. Lewis wrote one of his most interesting novels. It was, what's the name of it? It'll come to me in a minute. It was a retelling of it's the Orpheus and Eurydice myth.
Okay.
And Till We Have Faces. Till We Have Faces, that's it, you know.
All right.
And he tells it like a sort of a Christianized Neoplatonic allegory. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. So go read Until We Have Faces if you're into that sort of thing.
Hannah, thanks so much for your email. This is a great question here from Gregory. What is a good book for my friend to read? He is a Buddhist and is looking for happiness. He met a Catholic priest through me recently, and he said, I want what he has.
Yeah, a good book for your Buddhist friend who wants what the happy Catholic priest has.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of depends on where he's coming from, and it's hard to, you know, book recommendations are so particular to the person and their state of life and where their interests are and what they need at the time, so it's hard to know without more details what he's up to. But I would think that in general terms, Buddhists ought to familiarize themselves with Catholic mysticism and spiritual writers because it's the area where they're going to find both the most commonality and the most important subtlety of difference,
right?
Because while we overlap in some respects, there are some critical differences between, say, Buddhist meditation and Catholic contemplation.
And
if you get a handle on those, you really begin to grasp something of the genius of Catholicism. In particular, the Christian agape, Christian charity, is not the same thing as Buddhist compassion. I mean, it's something far deeper than that. And while there are some sort of similarities, I think you can get a handle on that. It really helps you differentiate the two traditions, even though they speak to a lot of the same existential concerns.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never picked up Catholic spiritual literature before, you might not want to dive into the deep end just at first. You might pick up somebody like Jacques Philippe, his book Time with God, Time for God. I always forget if it's Time with God or Time for God, but you'll find it, something like that.
Okay. Sounds good. And thank you so much for your question, Gregory. Here's one now from Robert. What is the Sunday Mass obligation, and are there ever any exceptions to it?
Sunday Mass obligation is a law in the Catholic Church that says all Catholics are to attend Mass on Sundays, also holy days of obligation. That is what it is.
Right? Okay.
Are there exceptions? Yep, there are exceptions. Let's say you are really sick. You don't go. Let's say that for reasons beyond your control, you find yourself in an environment where there is no Catholic Mass available. Well, you're exempt.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's say you are, for whatever reason, you're in a time and a place when the bishop exempts you from that obligation, as has happened actually quite recently in the American West. There are some bishops that have exempted people from their Mass obligation if they are worried about being deported from the country on the occasion of attending Mass, right? And bishops could dispense for other reasons, that we were dispensed from our Mass obligation during the recent COVID pandemic for obvious reasons. So, yeah, there are exceptions.
That actually happened to me when I was doing prison ministry some time back.
Oh, yeah?
And it just so happened on this particular Sunday that I was doing that, the celebrant for the Mass was our bishop. At the time, Bishop Foley. And I went to him and I said, I don't think I'm going to make it to that last chance Mass at 6 p.m. He said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. He let me off the hook.
He let you off the hook.
How about that? All right, here's a question now from Fernand, who says, I am an Orthodox Christian. Does that mean I cannot be saved?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, from a Catholic point of view, you could absolutely be saved. You can absolutely be saved. And the Catholic Church says that you do not have to be a card-carrying Catholic in order to be saved.
Mm.
Now, you know, the Orthodox view of Catholicism is a little different. Catholics have this doctrine that the truth and the fullness of grace are present in the Catholic Church, but that outside of Catholicism there are elements of truth and sanctification. And so sort of the further you get out in the concentric circles spreading out from Catholicism, maybe the fewer elements you have, but you never get so far out that there are no elements of truth and sanctification. Orthodox tend to resist that view. They tend to sort of think that, you know, the visible church as established by Christ just is the means of grace. And if somebody falls outside of that, then the best they can do is sort of say, well, you know, may God save them, but they don't have the sort of same degree of confidence that we do. And there are some Orthodox that will tend even to the position of saying, well, no, there's no salvation outside of Orthodoxy. So we don't have a symmetrical view one of the other, you know.
Okay.
Catholics are, I think, more generous in their view towards Orthodox salvation than Orthodox are in their view towards Catholic salvation.
We're going to sneak in this one. Thank you, Fernand. This one from Cecile, which will kind of take us out to the end of the show. Why aren't the Eucharistic miracles used as evidence in arguments for the true presence?
I think lots of people do that. I don't personally, but lots of people do. The reason I personally don't is that my faith in the real presence is, personally, my own faith in the real presence is not grounded in historical accident. And by accident, I don't mean unintentional. I mean something that's like not essential.
Okay.
It's not grounded in the historical accident of Eucharistic miracles. It's grounded in the teaching of Jesus. Like if there were no Eucharistic miracles, I would not stop believing in the real presence of Christ. I believe in the real presence of Christ on the testimony of Christ because of what Jesus said, not because of some empirical evidence. Because like I personally am not competent to evaluate the alleged evidence for Eucharistic miracles. At best, they're a kind of private revelation, right? They're not part of the dogma of the faith, the structure of the faith as such. And but many apologists make a big deal out of them, and they're welcome to, and the bishops say that's fine. That's not part of my apologetical arsenal, but it is for many people.
Cecile, glad we can answer your question today. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
We'll be right back at it the same time tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, for the Thursday edition of Call to Communion. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. Look forward to our visit tomorrow as well. Thanks. God bless.